Let's continue, DG. Let's continue with the meeting. I hope we all enjoyed the lunch and we are ready to continue with the work. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave at at 2:30. Honorable Mukacha will take over. So there's still some few more minutes. I have to attend to some emergency now. before 3. Honorable members, questions? Are we ready to engage? Are we happy with the report? It was quite a long but detailed report. We can't fault it because it is long as the report. The annual report is quite bulky as well. We understand it's quite a big portfolio, this one. Lots of money there. Honorable Mananiso, Honorable Boshoff, Honorable Nodada, and then we'll come back. I saw you, Honorable Sia. I saw some hands here. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me firstly welcome the report. Indeed, it is very explicit, and we are able to see what it is that they are doing right and wrong. My question is that on page 4, I can see that on their strategic overview, they've indicated that they didn't reach other targets that they could have targeted. So I want to check what is the mechanism in place to totally achieve the output that you have targeted yourself. And the other one is on page 7. Why is there a lack of meeting governance standards? Is it human capital or processes that need to be followed are not followed properly? On your slide, you indicated that there's a proportion of universities meeting standards of good governance. So for me, I believe when you are at a certain level, they shouldn't be compromised in terms of how you execute your mandate. So what is it that you have worked as a plan to ensure that you actually do what you're supposed to be doing at the right time? The other one is on page 7 as well. On slide 14, on the issue of the beneficiaries, you have indicated that your people that have benefited. Okay, it's okay. Now on 7, what I want to ask is that on slide 14 below, there are writings there that says 2017 academic year, 2017/18 NSFAS annual report. So I want to check if what you are sitting with is annual report of 2018 to 2019 or that one that is written below. It's on page 7. And Chairperson, again on page 10, slide number 19. The department has indicated their beneficiaries in terms of employment of local labor as female and male. But as a committee, we have made a commitment that ours is to check all the demographics in terms of the beneficiaries, be it youth, young people, black, white, and Indians. And we want to check if in the beneficiaries of male and female, are there young people who have benefited in this contract? And then page 16, on the issue of NSFAS grant. Again, on that one, because I can see every time it's issues of money is not reaching young people and so on. Is the problem there? People who are supposed to execute the role of ensuring that they disperse these monies, or is it a matter of this general corruption that people take this money for their own issues? Page 17. We've been told that every time there's certification of backlog. So I want to know, I've seen that you've indicated the quarterly thing that you'll be dealing with them. Can you have specifics so that as a portfolio committee, we are able to make you accountable of whatever that you could have said? Quarterly, it's very expensive. So can you be specific in terms of time frames and as well the volume, therefore, if it's with percentage? And then page 17, inconsistent, okay, let me leave that one of percentage and amount, because maybe that's how the department wanted to narrate the report. However, I want, can in future be consistent when you put amount, those billions and millions, you must do that up until, don't just decide within the report, you just do percentage and so on. Just as an advice to you, leadership. Page 43. Okay, I want to check what are the challenges with your department, because somewhere you have indicated that the thing is that Auditor General wants a report at a certain time. And for me, I believe that you shouldn't shift a blame. If you are a department reporting here, tell us about what are your issues. Don't tell us about somebody who had to come and say, I need this report, and the report is not there. Page 23 is the issue of CET. What is the plan of the department in terms of ensuring that it gets the specific attention like universities? Page 26, slide 50, the branch didn't have a specific target. Why? Because of on the report it says that they didn't have a specific target in terms of June. Why didn't they have a specific target? Because I believe you cannot work without having a target that you want to achieve. Why? For me, it is like there's something that is wrong that is happening there. And why people go to work while there's nothing that they're going to do? Page 27, are there any matters being picked up by SCOPA without speaking about investigations that have been alluded on? I want to check, as a committee, have you been subpoenaed by SCOPA in terms of trying to get sense of what is happening in your department? Page 28, slide 54. Okay, I'm done with it. Yeah, lastly, Chairperson, my issue is on the issues of FCM. Every time on these reports, we are being told that there are irregularities, and those irregularities, for me, it's lack of code of ethics in an institution. In your supply chain management departments, do you have relevant people to execute the job of public procurement and supply chain as supposed to, or not? If not, can the department find ways in terms of getting relevant people so that this thing of M&E, it doesn't become a lip service, but people ensure that they do what is right when they're supposed to? Because dealing with these issues, DG, you would know that it's all about project management. Whatever that you administer that you want to do, it has a scope of work. It has people who are responsible in terms of smaller tasks and so on. So please, can the department ensure that where there are no relevant people to execute this task of ensuring that TZCET gets relevant attention like your universities, you do that? Because of, as this particular portfolio committee, we have committed ourselves that we would want to see TVETS and CET be the institutions of choice for everybody. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Maybe on the certification backlog, we have scheduled a specific briefing on that one by the department on the first week of November, the on the 5th, to be specific. The 5th of November, we're expecting a detailed briefing on certification backlog of TVET colleges. It's the department, it's Umalusi, and it's SITA. So as members ask questions, please bear in mind that we're expecting a more detailed presentation on this matter. Okay, Honorable Boshoff.
Thank you, Chair. I want to refer to Program 4 TVET on slide number 38, where the percentage of TVET college maintenance expenditure in terms of approved infrastructure maintenance plans, of which 2.79% was reached. I mean, that isn't just, that is a huge, well, not deficit, but not having reached that. I wondered if the relevant officials could, out of their head, say something more about that. And then at slide 45 on page 23, there are certain reasons given for the lower enrollment for the CET colleges, which include unavailable of infrastructure. And I wondered what the targets was based on, because I would guess that one would use the available infrastructure as a reference point when targets are set. And then I just want to ask something in general, because it seems to me, now let's first say TVET and skills training, which is done by the CET, the Community Education and Training, had been with Labour, if I'm correct, and then it went to, it was added to higher education when higher education was formed as a separate department. And I wondered whether skills and artisanal training is sitting comfortably in the department. Have we reached the answer yet, or is there maybe still to something to happen before skills and artisanal training is where it is comfortable? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nodata.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. I think I would be doing an injustice if I didn't mention the fact that the Department of Higher Education and Training is really, really worrisome. And based on this report, I mean, I took this report with me over the weekend, this whole book, and I read through it. And I must say, it's actually very worrisome. You know, it's one thing to put funds in a department, even though it might not be enough to change the current circumstances or deal with the entire system. But at least the little funds that you have, which in fact this department gets a lot, you should actually use quite adequately and effectively. And when those funds are not used effectively and adequately, it obviously leads to, yes, having very high outputs in terms of graduates in universities, but people not finding work, for example. And beyond all of that, when you do put these funds in place and things like irregular expenditure happens, repeated offenses go on and on, and there's no consequence management. And the department comes and gives a report to say, these are the challenges. We are aware of the challenges. This is what we've tried to do about it, but this is what we think we're going to do about it. But come the next year, there's still the repeat of the same offenses. So I think, for me, my input is going to be based mostly on consequences, because I think that's where we're lacking the most in terms of achieving some of the targets or even progressing beyond the targets that we've set for ourselves. Now, I want to start by saying that let's start with the DG's presentation. I wanted to check, You're saying that 78 billion is mostly transfers from the department to the different entities. So you transfer money to NSFAS, the universities, and all those things. Well, 78 billion, particularly to universities, sorry. Is there any report that you get from universities based on the audit that they do internally, because they're autonomous, from them, where you can see what that money you've transferred is actually used for and is properly accounted for? And whether those targets that you would have strategically set as a department and a ministry, and as a ministry at DM, have been actually met by those institutions. So what accountability measures are there when it comes to institutions where you transfer money? Number two, I also wanted to check in terms of when you set the targets, there's an indication or there's a comment that says when you set the targets for good governance, there was no baseline to inform your target setting. So what actually informed your target setting to say that we're going to set 70% to measure good governance in these institutions vis-a-vis you achieving 80%? Why was the target set there, and which of those institutions did not meet that good governance target? So that we can track whether they're actually putting good practices in place to make sure that we meet the relevant targets based on the funding that they get. You mentioned that NSFAS has been giving challenges, and I did mention this in my previous input, and I think NSFAS is probably in shambles. If we don't try to think of a different way of dispersing funds, it might be a biggest challenge to what we're trying to achieve. You're saying that there's a number of students, so you put a figure there, saying that we've funded X amount of students based on your projections or whatever calculations you have. But at the same time, you're saying that the data that you're receiving from NSFAS is not correct. So how did you get to that number of students that you're saying that you're projecting that you are funding? Did you actually receive the audit report, as you've indicated in your comments, that you require from NSFAS? Did you actually receive the audit report from them indicating those numbers for you? Because, I mean, for me, if you're saying that the data is not correct, I don't think we should actually even believe those numbers to begin with. But maybe that's just my own view, but I'll hear your answer when it comes to that. That goes for both the universities and the TVET college. That question goes for both of those. And I just wanted to ask a question. In terms of the NSFAS funding that you transfer vis-a-vis the targets that you set, do you set those targets based on the money that you transfer to NSFAS that you would like to meet in terms of the students you would like to fund, or is that number just set from what? What is it set from? And what I'm trying to check is whether has there been no injustice of those discrepancies that happen in NSFAS that have actually left out, for example, in universities, 10,000 students, in TVET colleges, about 250,000 students who are eligible for funding, who could have studied in those institutions, who actually didn't get that money. So how do you you know, set those targets and link it with the budget itself? Coming to the TVET colleges, there are 22 TVET colleges that are repeat offenders when it comes to financial mismanagement. Can I just check what consequences have been put in place for people that are repeat offenders when it comes to money? Because, you know, we sometimes get mixed answers here. We asked how do you transfer money to TVET colleges for them to run the institution? If that's the case, you are saying you play an oversight role, you produce a report of an oversight that you have played, then what consequence management is there in place to avoid those things being happening over and over again? I wanted to check how many properties actually belong to the state, campuses that belong to the states that are TVET colleges. Because here you talk about an infrastructure grant that has been used to an X point. So all of these campuses that we have, there's 50 TVET colleges. There might be more than 50 campuses based on the fact that TVET colleges have more than one campus. How many of those campuses are actually owned by the state? Whether it's the municipality that owns those buildings, whether it's the provincial government, whether it's the national government, how many of them actually own those buildings? So that we can determine whether the maintenance of those campuses actually lies within the department, or it belongs to either a private entity or a municipality that, you know, has specific stipulations of whether you can renovate those spaces to make them disability friendly, or campuses that are actually going to teach what we would like to teach. CETAs, or let me not say CETAs, skills, the skills department in that space, I think it's quite appalling. And I think that's where consequence management comes in for me. You know, when you put a certain amount of money into something, there must be a return on investment. The DM spoke about having a lot of throughput in terms of people that are graduating and we're producing people and all these other things, you know? But right now we've got a very big challenge in South Africa. We've got over 10 million people that are unemployed. Yes, we're producing more people that are graduating, but you find that those people that you're producing are actually not skilled for what we need in the market, which is something that a conversation that we continuously raise. Now you've got a skills department that deals with the National Skills Fund, deals with CETAs. But when you look at the report, you find that there is so many instances of non-accountability in terms of what they've produced, what they've actually done. What have you used the money for? You know, I can't even pinpoint a lot of them because it's just in shambles. So I would just like to get an indication of what is this, the way that we're running the CETAs at the moment, is it actually beneficial to the skills outputs that we need as a country? Or are we just pumping money to people that are just devouring money? What consequences are there for these individuals that have actually broken the law? So what consequences are there? We can't keep on saying, coming in, debating, no, we need to have this budget for this and this, and then we give the budget. When we come back, you know, we get a half-hearted report, not even a half-hearted report. Some people are not accountable. There are no consequences. Come the next day, we still need to fund those people. So what consequences are there, particularly for what happened in the National Skills Fund, as well as the CETAs that have been identified, service CETA, and people that have not, that have accumulated interest by not paying and all those things. So what accountability and consequences have you put in place to make sure that the thing doesn't happen again? Then lastly, just on the CETs, I'm glad that at least there's some consequence management based on what the CFO has presented in terms of what has transpired with the fraudulent activity. I just wish that was happening across the department, but seemingly it's not. It seems like it's for selected few people when it comes to that. I just wanted to check, where are these CETs based? Where are they exactly based? And when you were saying that you've got a shortfall of the fact that there was not enough outreach programs to give knowledge about the CETs, what's your plan as a department to enhance that? Are you actually satisfied with the type of curriculum we produce there? Do you think it's actually sellable enough to those people that we seem to want to target? Just an overall question. Science and Innovation last week did a presentation about how many of these students have been through their bursary scheme or their system or their funding, or people that have attended their Expo, won awards, or won a scholarship, and they were able to track where they are. So when we say that, yes, we've met our targets in terms of graduates in the health science, whatever the case may be, or we've met our targets in skills development in the CETAs, do you actually track where those students are? Can you actually say this is a success rate? Or are we just pumping and just pushing, you know, and saying, look, we've achieved 12,000, we don't even know where they are, we probably don't care whether they've got a job or not. So I just wanted to check whether you are able to track that, and linking that with CETs. Are you able to track the students that actually get certificates from CETs, whether they're employed or not? And I think I'll stop there, Chair. It's just that,
You did say it was the last one.
Yeah, I did say it was the last one. I think I'm going to stop there.
Okay.
Even though I've got the moray of things that I want to say.
Yeah, you are very energized today.
Yeah. No, I just woke up from lunch. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, so because I'm going to leave now, I just want to ask my question, not questions, but just comments. because I'm going to leave now, Honorable Mukatra is going to take over. The AG raises an issue around record management, that the department must improve on its record keeping to support performance information. So the portfolio of evidence that you keep is not adequate enough. So I'm going to appeal to the department to make sure that you improve on that aspect. The second point I think that I would like to raise with you is the wasteful expenditure of 24 million that was incurred at CET. Maybe firstly to say that CFO, on slide number 58, you refer to this payment as erroneous payment. Is it erroneous or erroneous? Yeah. I don't think you should make such reference to this. This is a fraudulent payment, and you must describe it as such, as a fraudulent payment that was made, which has been followed up. Don't use erroneously paid, because erroneous means that there was good intentions, but somehow a mistake happened. So this was a deliberate action to defraud the state. So it's a fraud. It's a fraudulent payment that was made. So I think I know that as we are reporting, you're saying that it has been reported to the police. The police are investigating. But I think surely there must be proof that this person is the person who was responsible. Has there been arrest? Because surely this person or a couple of people who are responsible for this must be arrested. Must be arrested. You see, part of the reason why people do things and get away with it is that there is no immediate consequence for this type of actions. So you know this person is responsible for overpayment amounting 24 million. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. Firstly, for me, it's still a problem why it was not detected earlier. And now that it has been detected, why are people not being arrested? I think if you call it erroneous payment, you see, it's also saying, no, look, maybe there was a mistake in how this payment was done. So for me, I would like to see serious action being taken, both internal DC and the police arresting those who are responsible, and the full recovery. I mean, 12 million has been recovered, which is quite good, but would like all the money to be returned back to the state. All the 24 million. It's a lot of money. The other point, I think, look, I'm quite happy with how the report was presented, especially the financial statement. I think there's been more than sufficient disclosure, which is what we want. When you come and report to us, please disclose all the relevant information that you want, especially on the finances and the Auditor General's report and so forth. There was an issue about 138 million, which is an irregular expenditure, but it's not in the report that the AG briefed us on this morning. I understand that is something that comes from previous. I would like to find out when are you going to close that issue and make sure that it's done and it's buried. When you look at the AG's report, you have got, you received an unqualified with some findings. I guess the CET payment is one of the findings that was raised by the AG. And this other issue of also of record keepings and so forth about the financial, the performance information. But I think the department can is a very good candidate to move to a clean audit. Because when you check what has been presented here by the CFO, if you attend to all those things, which are not many, you will be in the league of those who are obtaining clean audits. So I think you must just focus on that. But the rest of the things, I think I'm fine with that. And I'm going to request that I must be excused. Honorable Litsia was next.
You will respond later. Okay. Now, thank you very much, Chair. Maybe you must welcome the the presentation from the department. Of course, I think the presentation on our emails looked the font there was fine. At least we must also commend them for that. It's only on printed media. I think the department wanted to save costs, the thing of going over the budget, as the CFO said, unauthorized. They wanted to avoid such things. Also acknowledge that the Auditor General's report believes that we had a fairly good audit. It's not. I think reported enough, especially with the department. When we are doing good, at least the department overall, I think the Auditor General believes that you had an unqualified with some findings, which is encouraging. It means you are not. We are not far off from where we want you to be. So the next step would be unqualified with no findings, including with all entities that reports to you. The Auditor General at least have taken us through certain elements which they look at when they deal with audits. One of them was financial statements. I also saw that the department itself had financial statements which were good. I wanted to read the correct. I can't seem to find it, but it says without material mistakes. Yes. but when you look at entities under yourself, it's a different story. It means serious issues of capacity, maybe serious issues of intent from these entities from achieving good things. So my question maybe then to the CFO would be, what measures, what have we put? I mean, clearly, if you can get that yourself, and you've got people that you are giving money on a monthly, on a yearly basis, or quarterly basis, billions of rands. Surely you can sit them down together with their internal auditors or whatever, or whoever is responsible for those things. Have a discussion with them about what is it that we want to achieve. I'm sure if the department can have such financial statements, other entities, unless they don't want to listen, unless they inform you straight that they don't they are not even attending those sessions that you might have planned in order for us to improve. So after you respond, maybe I must also make this point that so next year we don't want, I know on, I was just looking at the graphs here, on financial statements there are entities that actually regressed, those who were on financial statement unqualified with findings, others qualified, others unqualified with no findings, we've regressed, at least on financial statements, which suggests that there might be some games that are being played here by some people. Because for me, if in 2016, 17, 17, 18, our financial statements maybe were unqualified with findings, and in 2018, 19, we're getting a disclaimer, it means we know what is supposed to be done. We just decided not to do it. Now, for me, these things, maybe it's not for now, because we're having a conversation with you. It's not maybe something about them. I'm sure some of them are going to have a discussion with them directly. But as a department, this thing has consequences on your reputation as well. That as a department, you seem not to be doing what you are supposed to be doing, especially with some of the entities. I know that some of the things that you, you know, some of the audit outcome might not necessarily be because of your own doings. I'm sure if Pisinyana things that you could have done here, you would have gotten an unqualified with no findings, which is where we want to go. But in order for us to get there, it means because we're a big department, these entities, we must also drag them, take them with us towards the right direction. The department is, number two, the department has divided itself into branches, the skills branch, TVETs, CET and universities and so forth. The audit report indicates that there are serious problems in the skills, especially with CETAS. And TVET branch, of course the CET, I will not repeat. So it seems as if we've got challenges in all these branches. Is there anything that the department would have done, DG, sitting down with the heads, the DDGs responsible for these branches, in order to turn things around? I'm asking this because I saw somewhere in this report that some of these entities, some of these TVET colleges, are repeat offenders on the same thing. I'm sure even the judiciary of this country, if you are a repeat offender, you are not given. It's not easy. You are not easily getting bail. But here it seems as if we are we have a free for all kind of setup. There are no consequence management for these CETAS, these TVET colleges, these entities that report to us. If they repeat the same mistake, it doesn't matter. They know that the following year they will still get funding. So they will not improve on financial statements, they will not improve on leadership, they will not improve on all of other things that the AG reported on, including the PMFA and all of those things. It means whether or not the AG comes, they probably, wherever they are seated and saying, but we're not even paying the AG ourselves. So the AG will come here at the expense of their own budget, demand such statement, will rectify them as time goes, and if we get clean audit, so be it, but even if we don't, then who cares? I'm saying this because of some of these entities, their behavior on different aspects in governance, supply chain management, and so forth. So I'm just raising these things. I'm not lashing. I'm just raising them because I want you to go back. And maybe because we don't want to have the same conversation next year, maybe this time next year, or before the debates, budget votes, debates, Comrade DM, because really, if there are no consequence management, I don't see us as this committee going to budget votes and requesting more money for CITAS next year when we are not convinced that there's value for money. I think, Honorable, not that they covered me on the access versus success when he raised an issue of where are these people that were training with CITAS? Where are them? Can we trace them? Can we have a discussion as a department with these CITAS? Bring all of them and they must tell us, this year you are saying you have trained 20,000. Where are they? They are artisans. You produced 15,000 artisans this year. Where are they? Can we get a sense? Can we track them? Can we? Because I think for me, our success will be based on the department's success will be based on whether these entities that you give all of this money, that we give you, they are able to produce results. And that is what, at least on that part, I would have wanted to say. I think I'm avoiding going into individual cases because I'm sure this is the first time at least you are working with us. And we are here for a minimum of 5 years. I can guarantee you maybe next year will not be this kind. But we are giving you this thing so that at least we have a memorandum of understanding. Our terms of reference at least are clear. And the issue here is that, one, we want you to go and assist these entities to do what is right, so that when we get hard on them, hard on you, would be able to say, but this is what we have agreed on, that these were the issues that you had the past 2 years, but the next day we don't want any of them. We don't want to see anyone regressing on any of this, with the PMFA, the supply chain, on leadership, on financial statement. We want to see at least people are moving up. So if you are unchanged for the past 2 years on financial statement, we want to see you on the improved. If you are regressed, we want to see you at least taking one step forward. So we want a better report from the Auditor General that will speak to yourself. So CFO, maybe with your internal audit, assist these ones, these entities. I know it might be an issue of capacity and so forth, but find a way, be creative. There's at least 700 and something, or 12, or the 200 and something million that you did not spend last year. You could have done, maybe you could have been, I don't know, maybe I might contribute in making sure that you fail audit, because we have APPs. Maybe I was going to say if we have used that to capacitate others, but I then realized that also the audit outcomes depend on the APP. So that might not have been there. Maybe I would have ill-advised you, but maybe in future, let's not necessarily allow these entities to drag the name of the department. Lastly, also next time when you bring a report, your report kept telling us about, now we got 71 out of 75 targets, and some of those that, you know, you don't mention them and what were the challenges, so that at least when we engage on some of these things, we are able to say, okay, because when I was reading this presentation of yours during the weekend, I picked up that there might be a problem here. So when I make my own notes, I'm hoping that when you come and present, some of these gray areas might be answered. But if you are going to still be reading the same thing and without necessarily giving us examples of this, especially there, because remember, yeah, the AG with yourselves, especially when you're dealing with targets, you go into detail. So these are things that at least you know. You've just discussed now with the Auditor General that this target of training 5,000 people, we failed. And the reason we failed is because we had organized an imbizo in Grasrenet, for an example, and it rained. People did not come or something. There was no tar road, so the bus broke down, something like that. I'm making an example, not that. At least if you give us such things, we'll be able to say, no, maybe with an advice. You know, maybe sometimes we might not even ask questions. We might be coming only with myself and Honorable, not that. We might be coming with suggestions to say, no, maybe next time don't take it to Grasrenet, take it to Carltonville, where the book comes from, because there's tar road. You know, so, but that, for me, that is extremely important. Let's bring in specifics, especially on targets, so that we are able to know what are the issues and where are the problems. I think maybe let me leave it there. I don't want to go into specifics because your TVS, they give me a lot of stress. Your CETs, your CETs, when it's most, your CETs give me a lot of stress. Because, you know, and we're young, we don't want stress for now. So maybe let's avoid getting into those ones. It's still early, it's Tuesday. We don't want to be angry for the rest of the week. But at least let's improve moving forward. And I thought maybe I must just end the thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you. I think it's Honorable Sylvia.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. I left with one question. It has been said that the Chairperson who is chairing a disciplinary hearing or to investigate is not capacitated. Who is responsible to appoint a person? Is it a department or is it a president or who? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mam Sylvia. Honorable Boshoff of Yabo. Honorable Yabo.
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the presentation from the department, and I just need to understand. Excuse me. I just need to understand on slide number 19 and 20. the construction of TVET college campuses, I'm drawing attention to a new construction in Ngqongqoshe. Now, the DG makes mention that the project was supposed to be completed by the 3rd of October. Am I correct, DG? And it's interesting to see that it is at 36% of completion. And today is the 15th of October. The picture shown on it is a steel structure. What worries me is that slide number 20 says there are no challenges at this stage, DM. I can't reconcile 36% progress completion 2 weeks after the completion date and no challenges at this stage. I'm failing to reconcile the two. And I also noted that the DG makes mention that these campuses, and I'm speaking under correction, that these campuses are funded from the National Skills Fund. Is that also not public money? Is that not public funding, the National Skills Fund? Is it private funds? The oversight of the creation of campuses, is there a framework on how it's performed by the department? And how are these infrastructure development projects taken out to tender, and who manages that process? Because today it might be Ngqongqoshe, tomorrow it might be 2, 3, 4 campuses which are delayed, and the reasons provided are that there are challenges on the ground. In fact, in South Africa, there is no infrastructure development anywhere that is not met by people demanding 30%. 30% is now the song of the day. There needs to be a methodology of managing those issues. That's why we need people who will do social and stakeholder management to ensure that they unblock these challenges, and sometimes they are not even impossible to do. I mean, if you look at, by comparison, other projects, you can see that you are poised to see a completion by the envisaged completion date. So I'm looking at Umzimkhulu, it looks poised to be completed. It's at 72% of completion. It is due to be completed by the 30th of May, 2020. It is unacceptable that Ngqongqoshe is at 36% beyond the anticipated completion date. This tells me that the contractor is now operating effectively in penalty period. And I would want to know, is the contractor being penalized right now for running over the period of anticipated completion? Or is he been given condonation due to reasons stated and an extension on the completion date? I would need to understand that. I must also bring to the attention of the House that I don't believe it is proper to allow TVETs to continuously submit statements that are called, that are not compliant. the AG makes the point that there has been some improvement. But I think it's high time that people who use public funds understand that this money that they are given, it's not their money, it's the money of taxpayers. And proper accounting needs to happen. Because if you present statements that financial statements with material misstatements within them, it draws our attention to the question whether we have the necessary capacity in the institution to manage public funds. And if we do not have the necessary capacity, what is the department doing to correct the anomaly? Because I personally take umbrage to the fact that you have irregular expenditure sitting beyond 1 billion rand, 1.2 billion actually, at this moment, that could have been prevented had you had people with the necessary qualifications and capacity to handle running public institutions. And this is what these institutions are. TVET colleges are public institutions. If it's a question of capacity, what is the plan to correct it? If it is a question of delinquency, what has been done about it? And has there been a process to investigate which of the two it is? Is it capacity? Is it delinquency? And in each of the different cases, what are the steps that are being taken to ensure that by next year this time, you'll be sitting with people who present credible financial statements that are worthy of being audited by the Auditor General of South Africa. And these are concerns I think we all need to deal with. Where there is an issue of capacity, what are the policy measures that we have used to hire these people, and how long have they been there for? Because I think you cannot sit in a position and not develop. Even if you came in wet behind the ears, after a considerable period of time, you should have been taken through the reins to understand what it is that you need to do. TVET colleges must cease to become fiefdoms of umathanda, uzenzela, where people just go there and they feel, we are at TVET colleges. We can just produce substandard work, it's fine. And I would not even want to racialize the issue that the TVET colleges are treated that way by those who are supposed to treat them well and manage them well, because the vast majority of the people who go there are of my skin tone. I don't want to racialize it. But I want us to deal with the fulcrum of the issue, which is to ensure that accountability is the order of the day. We speak of consequence management, and I feel that the more we speak of consequence management means we are no longer dealing with people who are willing to help us develop South Africa moving forward. We are dealing with perennial delinquents who will do anything at all costs to collapse what we have given them to take care of. We cannot consistently be speaking consequence management. We have to be dealing with people who are patriotic enough to understand we are in a developmental project. We want to get our country right. Otherwise, if you keep on holding the stick, who is it that is going to do the right thing because it is the right thing to do and not because there is a stick waiting from the committee at every turn? We don't want to be slave drivers. We don't want to be continuously holding the stick. At least allow us the latitude to hold carrots, because you are patriotic. You understand that the duty of developing a country rests on the shoulders of those who are tasked with developing its future leaders through the education system. We cannot be concentrating on holding the stick all the time. Every second speaker has spoken of consequence management. How? Siyoxosha abantu abangapi? Siyobaxosha kube nini? I think we need to inculcate a paradigm of service, not delinquency. We cannot have professionals who go to school, qualify, and then come to collapse institutions. That paradigm must change. We ourselves don't want to come here. 80% of the time we must lament reports that come through because there are delinquencies we spot all the time. No, DG, ngiyacabanga ukuthi nawe mawubheke umsebenzi wakho, ufuna abantu abafuna ukusebenza, people who want to work, to build our country, patriots. So I want to encourage that let us change the trajectory of complaining because people do wrong things where they are supposed to do right things. A person who is honest is the one who is able to do the right thing without anyone watching over them. We are not here ukugadana nabantu abadala. We are here to ensure that the money that is issued to do work does exactly that. And that there are results at the end of the day that we are able to track growth, development, improvements over time. Sibamba amakherothi siyeke ukubamba induku. Sikhathele ukubamba induku. Sifuna ukubamba amakherothi. We want to congratulate you that you are doing well. It is encouraging that now 67% of TVETs are complying as it relates to the targets set for them by the department. But we would like to see numbers grow beyond the 90%. Can we chase that target? Can we chase that? And can we see irregular expenditure cut down from billions to mere couple of rands? Because people do the right thing. And not because of any other reason except that it is the right thing to do. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Yabo. On slide 33, are there any solutions that have been posed to the challenges listed? Maybe I've missed that part. On slide 38, number 5, can you explain the issue of the certification backlog in on that particular page? Because I don't think I understand that either. On slide 45, what is the commitment to addressing the issues listed there? I mean, with the amount of young people who are unskilled and unknowledgeable in our country, this really can't be a reality. On slide 59, I think Chair already spoke to it, but I'd like to reiterate it to say that we need to be very clear in terms of the disciplinary action that was taken on the individuals involved in the fraudulent salary payments in the CETs. But also on slide 63 to slide 65, we speak a lot about matters that are under investigation, but there's no clarity in terms of the timeframes of when those investigations need to be concluded or resolved. And then a big part of the challenges in higher education is our TVET and our CETs, and we've all committed from the beginning, I think from our journey when we went through the APPs, on how we'd really, really, in this administration, love to focus our energies towards balancing the scale between universities, TVET and CETs, or and CETAs as well. However, I'd like to have clarity as to why we still have acting DDGs in the program of TVETs and CETs, particularly because we were supposed to have concluded this issue, for example, with TVETs by the 11th of September 2018, with CETs by November. So just clarity as to where that process is, because I think Honorable Mananiso spoke to it earlier on, that the leadership of structures is a crucial part of whether or not what we're trying to achieve is achievable. That's the only questions that I have. So we'll allow the department under the leadership of the DG to respond. I don't know if Deputy Minister would have anything to... Sure. So under the leadership of the DG, we'll allow the department to respond. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I will ask my colleagues to come in on quite a number of some areas. But I think just for a minute to clear some of the things generally in respect to performance in the system. What we are there to monitor and to support institutions. One is prudent financial management. Hence, in the presentation, we spell out very clearly that one of the things that we monitor is the financial health of our institutions. And it's in respect to the funds that we are transferring them to carry out a number of activities that are supportive to teaching, learning, training, research, and community engagement. All right. And in that respect, we give account of how then the system as a whole is performing. And we collaborate that with information from quite a number of research bodies. I think it is not quite accurate to say that the efficiency and the effectiveness of the system as a whole is questionable. And as to whether what is being engaged and produced there, is it worthy of anything? If we're to believe the results of Stats SA, which says 92% of university graduates are employed, what other evidence do we have to dispute that? I don't have. But Stats SA is saying 92. I don't think, therefore, that is a fluke in terms of the quality of teaching and learning which is taking place there. And I think we presented it to the portfolio committee quite in detail. Not in flashy slides, but in numbers. If you may look at slide 13 and slide 14, where we are giving a detailed account in respect to how the system is performing, breaking it down to programs. Programs in the main in scarce and critical skills. For instance, if you look at slide 13, point 2, graduates in engineering science from universities. It's a passing target there. It goes on up to postgraduate level, giving detail of how the system is performing. Now, which means, therefore, if there is any worrisome, it may be in a particular specific area, but it's not general to the system. Of which then, if there is a worrisome area, particularly, we would like to understand what that is, so that we can be able to make a follow-up with a view of addressing it. I just thought I needed to clear that in respect to a detailed account that was given. I'll ask Dr. Parker in respect to universities to respond to quite a number of questions, because I don't want to make this my session and the portfolio committee. We are a team capacitated in various ways to deal with all these issues, because we believe in building capacity. They will respond. All right. Dr. Parker.
Thank you, DG. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I think DG has made the point around the employability of university graduates. But I think the issue of accountability is something that we take very seriously, as was mentioned around the financial health report. But I think specifically in relation to the question that was asked, was how do we hold institutions accountable to their enrollment targets, and to what we're expecting them to do within the system. And there are two specific mechanisms that we use. On the one hand, we have very, very targeted earmark grants around areas of capacity development, infrastructure, and so on. And in those particular grants, the way that we manage issues is that each institution has a plan, and we monitor the implementation of their plan. And where there is any shortfall, or if an institution doesn't spend the money the way they ought to be spending it, we withdraw funds and reallocate it for other areas that are important. One of the areas that we continuously reallocate towards is, for example, the new generation of academics program. So when institutions in the system aren't spending their money effectively, we then take that funding and we reinvest it into the capacity development of staff in the system. The other area is when institutions do not meet their targets. DG had indicated that there's a 2% target that is acceptable in terms of the enrollment plans. We negotiate with universities, and it's very difficult to get an exact number. So whether it's between 2% on either side of the target, we accept that. But should a university under-enroll more than the 2%, they are penalized in terms of their block grant the following year. So all institutions know this. It's something that has been put into place since 2014, and since then we've just seen continual improvement in terms of universities meeting targets. But there are sometimes unforeseeable circumstances at an institutional level that may result in some of those targets not being exactly as they had intended. Then I think the other issue in relation to this is I think the other question that was asked was the issue around planning for good governance. Why did we choose 70% as a target? What was the baseline? Why didn't we have a baseline, and so on? Just indicating that I think at the beginning of the last MTSF period, there was no measurement to try to understand what good governance meant in the system. And so there was a process towards firstly identifying what it meant, and we developed a guide for good governance at universities, which is available publicly. But what it does is it reflects on some of the governance failures in the past and shows what good practices would be. And included in that guide is a set of indicators that we ask universities to then measure themselves against. And at the same time, we also get, on an annual basis through the reporting regulations, annual reports from the institutions. And so in the previous year, what we needed to do was to set up an understanding of what the indicators would be for how we could measure good governance. And at the time when we came up with the 70%, it was we had looked at a very raw measure in terms of institutions that we thought were having problems, which gave us a target that we could indicate would improve, result in improvement in the system. And so from that perspective, we use that as the target. Now that we have worked on this and found something that the AG has agreed on in terms of the indicators, we have come up with an 80%. It's quite an interesting combination of aspects that give us that 80%, and we will be working with institutions to improve that year on year. Currently, we do have two institutions that are under administration, as you are aware. In terms of the issue of demographics of our student population and of the institution, the targets that we've set, we do have all that data. It is available publicly. We have a cohort report that comes out every year, and in that cohort report, we deal with the system as a whole, and particularly on the undergraduate side, how the system is performing. I think the other aspect that had been identified was the issue of whether or not we know where our graduates are. How do we track graduates in the system? Now, currently, what we expect institutions to do is do graduate destination studies, which they are involved in doing, and we also provide them with some support around that. Those graduate destination studies are meant to assist institutions to reflect back on what it is that they are producing for the system, and also to check and feed back into the development of their curricula. At the moment, the department does not track students out of higher education, but we track students inside the system. So we're able to, from an ID number, indicate where that student is within the higher education system. This issue of graduate destination studies, I think, is a very important one for us, and currently we're in a process together with University of South Africa to undertake a large-scale study to help us understand the destination of our graduates. I think, DG, we've covered most of them.
Thanks. Do you mind if I ask then, Tivet, Zach, have your answers fallen down? All right. Okay.
I've got the responses. Thank you, DG. Thank you, and dear members. In terms of the first question that we've received was the employment in local labour, specifically on the sites. We provided you with statistics on male and female. We don't have the detail specifically on young people, but what I can say is that the people working on the construction sites, the local labour, are usually people that works, if they had to lay bricks as an example, that will constitute local labour. We will get you the statistics, but on inquiry, it's below 30 age that usually is involved in the construction sites. That's about 30 and lower, up until even to 18 years of old, or even 17. So we'll get you the statistics on that, but obviously that is on the brick laying side. Advocate Bosef asked the CIEG expenditure, why is it so low? So for quarter one, we've noted that the expenditure is approximately 3% versus the target that we've set for quarter one at 40%. The reason why the infrastructure spending is so low at this stage, if you recall what DJ also said, these funds are quite new. We've received it 18-19 and now going forward 19-20. So the TVET colleges in itself, since recapitalization, they never created the required capacity to be able to deal with repairs and maintenance and infrastructure maintenance specifically. Due to the lack of funding, it wasn't prioritized then. What we've been doing now is we have invested comprehensively in TVET colleges in terms of training, and we've initiated, we call it the NIAM standards, National Infrastructure Asset Management Standards. Now, to do that, in terms of the NIMS standards, it takes time to regulate and get the processes intact. If we don't initiate NIMS, the money might be spent inappropriately, and that's not what we want. So what we anticipate now, I can tell you the quarter two expenses is now at 18%. So we're expecting the expenditure curve to really increase in about the next 6 months. But we had to initiate extensive training, standards, standard operating procedures, so that took a lot of time.
And I think now just to see a low expenses on a system that has never had it previously, yes, that skews the picture. So that's where we are on the infrastructure, but it's definitely going to pick up. Your other question was, what linkage do we have on the skills artisan programs, as an example, and TVET colleges making that link? So we've established the centers of specialization, 20 colleges rendering 13 occupational programs. It's a small step, but it's a step in the right direction. Now, for 2020, the enrollment plan is envisaged at 2,050 intake. So it's small numbers, but that is the vision. Now, that includes three areas. It's just practical, your theoretical, and your workplace training. And that's where we interlink directly with the CETAS as well. So it's small steps, but we're going into the right direction. NASFAS, you had questions on NASFAS targets. The NASFAS target on the TVET side, if you look at 18-19 and you look at 19-20, the APPs, 18-19 was based on what the funding can provide. You asked that question. That was provided like that. The new APP for 19-20 was revised now to fit rather the NASFAS trend. So that is to answer your question on that one. So you asked on NASFAS data as well. Now, yes, we know that the NASFAS data is quite not accurate at this stage, and that links to the qualification that we've received. So the NASFAS data is an issue that needs to be attended to, as indicated by the DG, but again indicating that it's about what the trend analysis for qualifying students that informs the new target in 1920. Okay, good.
Sorry, Jeff. Just a small, quick clarity.
I just wanted to check, the reason I asked the question, so if you're saying you funded 200,000 students, the students that qualify are 400,000 plus, is that what you're saying? And of those students, there's 200,000 students you funded, meaning those that are now left over, people that qualify that could be eligible for funding but didn't get the funding. That's the question, that I think that's where the key for me is.
The funding by NASFAS, it's based on two things. One is the determination of the 350 cap of combined family income per annum. Then the second area, it relates to progression, which relates to meeting academic standards going forward. But because there have been these challenges in respect to TVET colleges, if you are looking at pass rate, you know, in the overall, which actually means that the high volumes at the entrance level that have gone through, when now it becomes to determination for progression, you take a bit of a knock there. That's why some of the interventions that we spoke about earlier on, of the introducing pre-learning programs, like foundation phase programs, because at some stage universities were faced with this challenge. We then introduced foundation phase learning programs so that as they come into institutions, they are then assisted to acclimatize, understand the environment, and build the necessary capacity so that when they start with fully-fledged programs, they are able to progress. So there are quite a number of interventions that are being addressed in that respect. The other dimension we clarified earlier on is that the data which is in there at NASFAS. Now, there is an anomaly in respect to its authenticity because the funding cycle of 2017 had huge problems whereby the integration of data between a college registration and NASFAS data became quite disruptive, to an extent that quite a number of students, though they have qualified for funding, they were not necessarily uploaded and
captured in the NSFAS database. 2018, again, that then started to improve when the administrator came in August, I think 23rd of August 2018, with a mandate of addressing and closing the funding cycle of 2017 and 2018, and then preparing for new applications for 2019. Now, if you look at 2019, by all accounts, the system has been hugely successful, institution by institution. It's where now the credible data is emerging. So there is that anomaly I think we needed to take into consideration in respect to figures that are derived from the database of NSFAS. Thank you very much.
You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. The next question was on the TVET audit outcomes. Just to recap, the current 2018 audit outcomes, I think as indicated by the AG, we are sitting with 23 unqualified audits, which is 23 out of 50. We're sitting with 21 qualified audits, 3 disclaimers, and 3 are currently outstanding. So specifically, if you look at the improvements from 2017, we had 8 improvements, which I'm not going to give you the detail, but we had 8 improvements, we had 2 regressions, and the remaining was unchanged. If you do the math, there is still a small improvement in the system. So that's about 3 out of 50 will give you about a 7% movement. So if you recall where we were years ago about when the AG started, if you look at where the system was and where it's now, we have been moving the disclaimers. So even though there are still negative audit outcomes, the majority of them are now on qualified status. So we've moved the system from disclaimer to qualified. That must be noted to say that what interventions were initiated since then. Linked to what the department does on the question on monitoring and evaluation, we've initiated processes called the 381J requirement, this is the PFMI. Our primary focus is focused on the ones with disclaimers at this point. So we work hand in hand with these colleges of disclaimers. We've identified 6 from 2017. Remember that I said there's only 3 left on disclaimers for 2018, but we are focusing and guiding them through the audit action plan processes, working with the audit committees, through the 381J process. So I just want to give a bit of context in terms of where we're sitting with the financial statement in terms of that. The next question that we had was on the TVET campuses, how many are owned by colleges, and may we incur expenses on sites we don't own? So we've got approximately 270-odd sites, of which about 90% of them are owned by the colleges themselves. There are still a few sites that's owned by Department of Public Works as an example. What is important to note, when we spend money on infrastructure, there's repairs and maintenance. We made a decision to even spend on those sites we don't own. And the reason being is that it affects students. If you've got students enrolled in those sites, it's about health and safety of the students, even though you don't own the site. What we did say is don't invest extensive capital on those sites, but at least bring it to the required quality and level of safety and health. As an example, ablution facilities and so forth. So that do require investment in infrastructure, even though the site is not directly owned by the TVET College. Then the last question that I'm going to ask respond to is our infrastructure site, where you said we had to reconcile the date of September versus the financial 36%. That site has been extensively delayed through social community, as indicated, and challenges by the Director General. What that now entails is that while that date is still reflecting that date as per contract, we are now waiting for the extension of time from the principal agent to assess the implications. It might have financial implications, it might not. Remember, if it's an issue that's not in the direct control of the contractor, if it's a social issue, you will get an extension of time without costs. it will attract escalation. So as soon as we get the extension of time, we will then amend the contract amendment if the extension of time has been approved. So again, indicating that we are still on track. It is extensively delayed, but currently it is even said no challenges. It has been resolved as we stand now, but now we're expecting the extension of time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, honorable members. For the CET, there was a question about what informs our target setting given the lack of resources that we have. Our target setting is informed by baseline. In this case, the 320,000 that you see there, which could not be achieved, the baseline there was 300,000. And therefore, we set then this target looking at that baseline. But also, we also looked at previous baselines that were there prior to the migration of the function to the Department of Higher Education and Training. And you'll find that the enrollments would actually be around 300 and 320,000 and so on. So that figure has always been consistently there, and we therefore used that to set this target. Now, I just want to also just elaborate to say that in terms of us not achieving that figure, the DG did indicate that we also have an issue of limitation of infrastructure, which is one of the major contributing factors why we are unable to attract the numbers that we actually intend to have in the space. The majority of our centers, there was a question, where are we based? We do have 9 community education and training colleges in the country, 1 in each province. But under them, there are community learning centers which are spread across, and they are mainly in the communities. But the disadvantage there is that these community learning centers are operating from schools. Now, you realize that when they operate from schools, it therefore means that tuition can only happen when the school is out or in the evenings and so on. Now, this affects the people that you're attracting, because for some of them, when we did our own monitoring to find out what are the issues, we'll find that some of them are citing issues of safety, of security, just coming in the evenings today. And for the programs that we also want to offer, it's a disadvantage, because when we operate in schools, it therefore means that we are unable to innovate and do some of the programs that we actually then want to do. So there are those factors that are actually contributing to the enrollment as you see it. In terms of our outreach, there was a question there to say there's lack of advocacy. Yes, the colleges do try to have some form of advocacy there and there in the communities, but we've realized that we need to assist them, and we started by targeting, advocating through the media. And what we did was that we approached community radio stations, because that's where the people that we are targeting are mainly, you know, listening to those stations in terms of the monitoring that we actually did. And we did see a change, because the colleges reported that after we did that with the community radio stations, the number of calls that came through from people who are now being interested, wanting to know more about the community education and training colleges. But we agree that it is an area that we actually need to do more on. And as for us internally as a branch, we are also developing a national communication strategy which is going to assist the college, so that even from a national point of view, there is that kind of advocacy that we actually do, that people are actually aware of the colleges. The question about whether the curriculum is actually relevant to what we are offering, yes, we believe the curriculum is actually relevant, because for instance, if I'm to state the certification that you see there, which is 41% where we achieved, it is a qualification that is the General Education and Training Certificate, which is at NQF Level 1. And we see the majority of the people who are coming into that who have done maybe up to secondary school, and so who are youth and others who come into the space. But we are also, in the near future, we'll be introducing what we call the National Certificate for others, which is an equivalent of metric and so on. So we are really making sure that which we are offering is really being responsive to the people that we are attracting in the space. Thank you.
Thanks very much, DG. Honorable members, I just want to share some quick infographic because there's been an issue around especially the impact of the programs that our CETAs do offer. NSA will be here next week, of course, is going to share with you a report, the study that we have done from 2011 to 2016, 1st April 2011 to 31st March 2016. That report is going to tell you that the beneficiaries of CETA programs from that five-year period is equal to just above 1 million. The completion rate or the throughput rate there is standing at 77%, quite very high if we compare to any other related area. Also conducted the survey with employers. What are the employers say about those who are trained by CETAs? They are saying 80% there is improved productivity. 79% there is a quality regarding the products. That's employers. Work readiness, so they are saying 74.7%. So there is increased work readiness to the learners. Decrease in errors, so they are saying 73.3%. of those who participated into these programs, they've seen that there is a decrease in errors. Also, I just want to quickly indicate regarding artisan development. We conducted, as you think we reported as well in this report that we presented today, that in 2017-2018, there were 21,151 artisans found competent in the country. Out of that, when you look into the absorption rate, it is equal to 77%, quite very high. If we compare with the absorption rate of the previous year, that is 16 and 17, also is in the annual report, that was equal to 60%. So it tells us, therefore, that the impact is there, but we need to continue to ratchet, especially regarding to artisan development as well as learnerships. It's interesting as well because Human Sciences Research Council also conducted its own study, is telling us that 86% of those who participated in learnerships, they are easily absorbed, and 70% those who participated in apprenticeship programs are easily absorbed. I just wanted to share that infographic, but then, of course, NSA will do the presentation as well next week. Thanks very much, DG, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members.
Thank you, infographic. Can we look in finances now and some HR matters by the CFO? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, DG. Chair, I will be very brief just to say that we appreciate the comments made. We take note of those. I do believe that that is not only especially the issue of the outcome of the financial reports, the outcome of the audits at institutions and entities, not only a matter for the Office of the CFO, but for the department as a whole. It really addresses as well the issue of monitoring and evaluation of what is going on the ground. It was already mentioned, and I would want to emphasize the Section 38.1J reports that we are currently looking at as a first step. Annually, each institution and each entity that receives transfers from the department must issue, in terms of the PFMA Section 38 certificate. So this year, we started 1 April this year, the first year that we start to set conditions, the moment that an entity has specific circumstances, for example, a disclaimer audit outcome, institution that's being placed under administration, where there are then certain conditions attached to the transfers that we make to them. Those are reported and monitored on a quarterly basis, so that we start to put in place certain steps and measures to influence the outcome of the audits and the transfers that we are making. So we do appreciate everything that's being said, and we will definitely look into those, and hopefully we may see some improvement in the years to come. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Lastly, in respect to what has happened in the CET, 24 million.
forensic investigation has been instituted. The matter has also been reported to Hawks and the police to assist in the investigation. And much progress has been made, but no arrest as yet in that regard by law enforcement agencies. Now, some of these staff members, they've jumped ship. They are no longer in the employ of the department, especially the main culprit. But all what we're able to seize as a department, we've done so. We've withheld pensions and other monies that are due to the main culprit. Other members, officials who benefited out of this, not out of their own initiative, but they've been offered, they've since signed agreement forms to pay back the money. That's why already we've been able to recover about 11 million of that amount, and we're still recovering. Now, with the withholding of pensions and other monies, and also insisting on Hawks to freeze assets, you know, of the main culprit. The main culprit on pensions has taken us to the public protector that we're not paying him his money. I'm just trying to indicate how at times the people who are stealing become so emboldened. All right. But we're dealing with that matter with the public protector. And I concur with the honorable member in respect to the question of the accountability, you know, in the system. And we always throw ourselves, you know, out. And we suffer quite vicious attacks and aberrations in the process. Fought before it was put under administration, that terrain was really a tug of war, to the extent the people who were messing up the institution managed to get the vice chancellor out. So we had to intervene. I think I was sent there by the minister then, twice in a week. And it's an environment which is supposed to be academic, but some senior managers had to be provided security for 24 hours. We've got a report by the investigators. All right. But one of the two things they are singling out, three in actual fact, is the question of co-governance that has been imposed in the institution, co-management that has been imposed in the institution. And the environment has gone to the extent that those who are standing for the truth are the ones who do not want to be identified because of fear of reprisal. Those who are encouraged to stand up and voice their views are the ones who have brought the institution down. So the culture of fear, of intimidation, the reign of fear in some of our institutions is too huge to contemplate. I raised my case there, Chair, on that note, but we're working on all of these matters. Thank you very much.
I note two hands, three. Comrades, can we be as succinct as possible? Honorable Mapulane, Honorable Zizia, and then Honorable Yabo.
Yeah, no, Chair, I had to deal with my emergency, so I'm back now. So the emergency has dissipated. Chair, I thought the gentleman who's responsible for TVETs
will elaborate on the issue of the audit outcomes there in the TVET, because the picture doesn't look very good. The picture is quite bad. One of the things that the Auditor General has raised is the fact that there used to be CFOs who were seconded as a result of the contract to the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. That contract has come to an end, and as a result, there is no sustainability of the systems that were introduced by the CFOs who were there. I thought that you will reflect on that and tell us what then is going to happen in the absence of such. The picture that we saw is quite is not a very encouraging one, despite your optimism. The improvements that are there are very negligible, very minor improvement. We're still sitting with a situation where there is three sitters who have not submitted financial statements as yet. We don't have an indication on when are they going to submit those statements so that they can be audited. So I don't think we should put a rosy picture about what's happening in the sitters. We understand the historical context, but things as they are, they need some intervention, serious intervention for that matter. On the university's chair, look, I know that it's quite a massive system that we're dealing with. Universities which are autonomous have their own institutional autonomy and so forth. but they are receiving funding from the department at the end of the day. And the department and ourselves, who must hold them to account. They are 26. We'll have to find a way of selecting the worst performers to come and account here in Parliament. Because they've already, you know, fought here in the red with a disclaimer. Some other institutions that have regressed in terms of the audit outcomes. We don't even have a full picture of the true state of their finances, those institutions. But I've just received, Chair, some correspondence of a complaint, the details which I will be able to share them later, of one institution, TUT, there, that it doesn't look like things are rosy there, especially in terms of governance, which flows, you know, into issues of management, some interference there, which at an appropriate time, I think, we should be able to deal with it. But I'm still not happy with the response about the culprit not being arrested. It's not your responsibility to arrest, but action has to be taken. You know, somebody gets so emboldened because you're not doing anything against that person to even take matters to the public protector. You know, I mean, it's something that it requires to be followed up very speedily with subs. I mean, thank you.
Honorable Ezea.
No, thanks, Chair. Just one follow-up. I'm not really satisfied with the response from the department TVET branch. The response was to a question I would have raised about the department assisting these TVET colleges, a variety of things, as per the report of the Auditor General. And the response from, I'm sure the DDG says, there has been improvement in the past 3 years or so, where when they intervened, they had 6 with disclaimers, they are now left with 3 or something like that. And they decided to concentrate on those with disclaimers. You see, if we're going to do things that way, it's going to take us 15 years to 20 years to get these institutions to have clean audits. And unfortunately, we don't have that time. We don't have 20 years to wait for these institutions. And I said, the Auditor General of South Africa, they've got 5 areas of concentration when they do the audits. Now, Rona, as the gentleman says, we want to concentrate on these 6 that 3 years ago had the disclaimer. in fact, it might not even take us 20 years, it might take us more. Because out of those who did not have disclaimer, who are not part of the flagged 6, there are those who have regressed. And you don't see anything wrong. Because you're only concentrating on those that had serious problems of disclaimers from 3 years ago. There are those who are doing well. Well, maybe not well, but those who are doing fairly well, who have regressed. And you are coming here with a response for me that is quite frankly out of order. We must agree, I think, Chair, that there must be systems in place in helping these TVET colleges. Because like we said, we're dealing with public funds. We're dealing with money that belongs to the state, belongs to the people of this country. And ours here is to make sure that we are able to account for each cent that has been allocated. And I don't want us to go around in circles. After three more years from now, these ones with disclaimers will be 5, possibly on financial statement. But we'll have 47 that will be getting disclaimers. So we must now go back and start afresh with those ones. So I'm really not happy with the response. I think we must agree that as much as the response should have said, as much as we've put in more effort on this one, we've also, or maybe in the first year, we made a mistake by saying we're only going to assist this one. But now we're seeing that there's a problem with others as well, especially after the withdrawal of those CEOs through that program. So there's a serious problem. We're now going to assist everybody. And this is how we're going to assist them. I think that will assist us. supply chain management. It's just that we did not go deep into this report. Supply chain management, everywhere you go, it's an advert of some company that says everywhere you go, but everywhere you really go, the people of this country believe that, especially with government, our supply chain management is really not there. It means we're taking the money belonging to the people through supply chain, we're taking it to pockets, to our own pockets. And we're not going to keep quiet here and behave as if we don't know these things. Yes, we might not know if it's true or not, but we're saying the Auditor General, you know, they... some of these things, they may not pick them up because what they deal with, when I was reading, when we attended their crash course, they check whether you have your supply chain, you followed your own supply chain rules. And if you have followed them, you know, and you know there are many ways of cheating the system, so to say. For an example, let's say, for an example, a TVET college wants to replace or repair some of the things there with the grants that you give them of maintenance and so forth. They're able to, if they don't use the softwares that, you know, your internet, they probably want you to submit codes, you know, on paper. They're able to take those that might have been cheaper so that they can manipulate the system. And then, but when the Auditor General comes, the price that, or the codes that they get might not necessarily be the price that they that may have been submitted because of all of, so they might not pick that up. But the system might have been cheated greatly. So we have not even entered into those things. We don't want to enter into those things, maybe for now. But we are saying we are not going to accept that. We are saying you are only going to concentrate on one section out of the five, and it was only six out of the 50, and three have improved, three are still there, but when there are regressions, I think we must agree, Chair, that that answer, you know, was insufficient, or the response was not in line with the vision we want to take, we want to work with the department in taking this country forward. We want to change the image first and foremost, including with all others, the CETs, the skills and so forth. Want to change the narrative out there that the department is not doing anything, and Parliament is just a place of where old people who are tired to go to, called retirement village. It's not. It must not be true. So we want to change those things. Make sure that everybody is held accountable, including ourselves. But we produce results. We produce results. There must just be positive things coming out of the department. So, and like I said earlier on, we are not saying these things fighting. We are saying let us work together in achieving this target. But let's have other plans of assisting these entities that reports to the department. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. let me just say, slide number 69 is slightly confusing in how it's put together. So the amounts written, all of them have million after the numbers. And it's very difficult to read such a number. So, 69, page 35. So, perhaps if a correction or clarity is provided on the actual numbers, because they don't make sense to me at this moment. I want to raise an issue that is very close to my heart as it relates to the, and I want to put it succinctly because I spoke to it in my maiden speech to Parliament on the budget process, budget vote process. Now, I want to raise it because I feel that if we do not have plans to address it adequately, it will continue to be a problem for years to come. And the issue I want to raise is around developing spaces as it relates to the development of infrastructure, developing spaces that are comprehensive. So you develop a space that is fit for studying, that is also able to accommodate recreation for the student. In essence, a student village of sorts when you develop infrastructure. And to address backlogs that relate to student accommodation. Because the current situation or status quo develops or sustains, not even develops, sustains a societal anomaly. And the societal anomaly impacts mainly on the female gender. On the female gender. So you've got universities which do not have adequate beds for students, creating a necessity for students to look for accommodation in the neighboring spaces, more especially those universities which we term to be historically disadvantaged. And the female students are then exposed to social dangers because of lack of adequate infrastructure to accommodate them in the form of beds, and not just beds, but the ability to sustain a life with minimal needs, particularly for those students from poor backgrounds. So if you create a situation where the child has to spend money on transport, you are creating a need that they can fund themselves. And sometimes the money that we give through NSFAS is not adequate to even cover those appurtenant expenses created inconsequentially because we don't have beds. And it creates a what we call the blesser blessee situation. Yes. Blesser blessee, DG. Yes. Where young women expose themselves to older men for subsistence and financial gain because they come from poor backgrounds. They cannot sustain their lifestyle on campuses. By the time it gets to the 12th day of the month, they are depleted where funds are concerned. They are forced to look for money elsewhere. And it's a sad situation which we must look at holistically because of what it breeds in society. Because we must present responses that are able to create a society all of us will be proud to live in. We speak of gender-based violence, but we create spaces that leave these young women who are vulnerable open to abuse by older men who are financially viable, because they exploit their situation. If we are to address issues of gender-based violence and the eradication of patriarchy in the higher education space, we need to address the cause and effect. Let's deal with cause and effect. It may look minimal, but it becomes a big problem if it affects your own child. And sometimes we leave it because maybe we can afford to take our children through higher education institutions without them needing to depend on a blesser. But that is an effect that is caused by, one, the lack of beds, adequate facilities that speak to a holistic, comprehensive development of infrastructure, catering for the needs of a student, not just the ability to study, but to have a student life that allows them to enter, study, qualify, and exit to the workplace adequately qualified and skilled without having had to deal with adulting issues. Adulting issues in between achieving their goal. And I just wanted to put it on record that in our planning, we need to address that plight. It's a very serious plight. I saw a picture recently, in actual fact, it was shared by the whip of our committee, of kids staying in one room
crowded. Beds, mattresses, everywhere. And it's untenable. Because they are forced to share one room, six, seven of them at a time. It's really untenable. It cannot be that the education system replicates the mining system of gold, of hostels, in Gomboni. Our university is in Gomboni. Because abantwana balala bay 6, bay 7, bay 8, they're rooming. We need to address it. And I think it's urgent. Thank you, Chair.
You can now respond, DG.
No, thank you very much. Maybe let me start with this question of the student accommodation. Though it's not part of the annual report, but I think it's quite crucial, you know, that. Firstly, the study that we have conducted in respect to student accommodation in 2012 came out with a report that only about 20% of student population is housed in university-owned accommodation. 80% of them, they are out there in the private space of one form or the other. And the study then indicates also that those institutions that are in rural areas, they are more adversely affected in terms of the quality of accommodation they are able to get even in the private space. The conditions are quite appalling. We then looked at the budget that we are having as government in respect to responding to this challenge. Treasury came to the party and injected quite substantially. But the money that we have from the coffers of the state would allow only to roll out 30,000 extra beds over a period of 10 years. We then in the department worked out quite a number of interventions that one may think of. We engaged with fund managers, insurance companies, development finance institutions, banks, out of which we established a committee that has to look at this matter in respect to what could be an appropriate policy framework that can allow the private sector to come to the party and invest in student accommodation. And that resulted in a housing student accommodation symposium that we held in 2016 at UNISA, where all these fund managers and bankers, you know, were there. Out of that process, we then streamlined our processes and engagements. We got substantial funding from DBSA, because our calculation pointed to the fact that for us to be able to make a dent, we need in the next 10 years to roll out student accommodation up to 300,000 new beds in the system. We established a structure between ourselves, the Department of Higher Education and Training, Development Bank of Southern Africa, the National Treasury, to work out the soliciting of extra funding from the private space to come into our institutions and invest in student accommodation. Worked out a program, rollout program, and we identified institutions that are in serious distress in respect to this question. As we speak now,
to cut a long story short, about 8 or 9 institutions die are benefiting quite massively in this rollout. It has started. UniZulu, we are rolling out more than 3,000 beds out of this joint funding. University of Water, WUSU, Venda, Nelson Mandela, Northwest, Mahikeng Campus, you name them, UWC as well. Yes, SMU. Now, if I may just make a specific example, I would encourage honorable members to go to the University of Forte and see the first phase of this rollout in that institution. As a department, we made available 122 million. DPSA put up 278 million. IPSA, through National Treasury, that is Infrastructure Investment Project of Southern Africa, that is EU funding, they put up 28 million. The planning and execution is meticulous. It starts at the feasibility study. It goes to architectural design, to procurement, with high capacity engineers, quantity surveyors, and architects. All right. At Forte, I think they were handing over keys in the first phase, and they are continuing. Because we are looking at rolling out 300,000 new beds over the 10-year period from now going forward. 200,000 for universities, 100,000 for TVET colleges. So it's a matter that is receiving our attention. That committee is chaired by myself, and we're meeting quarterly to work out on processes and unblocking blockages at institutional level in respect to the infrastructure rollout, taking into consideration the notion of the student village with all the facilities that are required in a learning environment. It's there, it's happening. It's not that enough. What encouraged me, Asisa, when we were at Forte, they were there and they said they wanted to see as to whether this thing is becoming a success, because themselves, they want to come and invest. So these success initiatives in these institutions are giving government huge prospects of more monies to be invested in student accommodation. Now, let's come to this question of TVET colleges. One, TVET colleges are not a subject of PMFE. They are a subject of Community Education and Training Act of 2006 as amended, which stipulates that the practices that these colleges put in place should not be inferior to that of the MPFE. What we then did, we engaged with AT out of our initiative as a Department of Higher Education and Training, because colleges were not audited up to 2015 from time immemorial. Now, in 2016, we requested AG come to the party and just start with a pilot, because we want to establish the nature of the control environment in terms of financial management in the TVET college space. Working also with SAICA, that report came out. It was scary. But out of that report, we developed a comprehensive schedule that identifies all control lapses and the actions that are required in respect to governance, HR finances. And further to that, working with SAICA, with assistance of the AG, we develop a package of policy environment that TVET colleges should actually consider in respect to financial management, and assigned each with a SAICA CFO. You're correct when you are talking about that, but it has come to an end. But as an exit strategy, what we have done, we have created posts of financial managers at a deputy principal level. We wanted them to be at the principal level, but according to DPSA evaluation, they said, no, let's put them at deputy director level, which they are there at the present moment. And we advertised posts and appointed CFOs in each and every college. I think if I'm correct, Zach, 43 colleges have been covered the last time I get the statistics. I don't know whether we've moved up.
It's 42, DJ.
Yes. It's 42.
Correct.
Yeah, no, I'm not too far away from the mark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 43 minus 1. It's 42. All right? And the remaining ones, we are planning to fill those posts quite recently. Soon, there are processes in place. Now, the first audit was scary, as I said. AG, here, can attest to that. Now, since then, we managed to roll out auditing to all colleges so that we can have a picture of all of them. And the way AG reported this time is giving us a very clear picture. The report is saying 10 colleges have improved. I think we need to appreciate that. The colleges that have regressed are three. One regressed from clean audit to unqualified. So it means two that have really regressed to a bad situation. Now, in respect then to the colleges that got clean audit, it's six. It's Elangeni. It's Maluti. Maluti is in Free State. It's North Link. It's West Coast TVET College, it's Fort Bay, it's South Cape. And 17 of them got unqualified audit opinion. All right. Now, qualified is 21. But what that means, qualified, it means policies are there. It means systems are there. It means processes and procedures are there. Then AG is able to then look at how they are performing against what is in existence. I think we need to encourage that and work towards taking it to the next level. The worry, though, is in respect to disclaimers that we must work on to take them out. So that is our plan, and that we are doing day in, day out, and we're quite optimistic we'll get them there. The area that we would like assistance on from these honorable members is the support to governance structures in these institutions, support to management structures in these institutions, because what normally undercuts their performance, it's when in some instances, in some institutions, interest groups are elevated above the governance structures and the management structures in these institutions, which is the case even at Forte at the present moment, at least according to the investigation report
that we have received. We are not talking here perspectives or assumptions. We are talking on things that are concrete. Because the picture that is emerging, in an instance where interest groups got elevated above governance structures and management structures, you get everything wrong. And it's not a popular space to engage in, that one. I submit, but it's a matter that we have to actually work on with your assistance as well as honorable members, because in the main, that is the space you occupy best, that one. Hence, your guidance and assistance would be needed from time to time. That's the submission, Chair, that we could be making in respect to the two issues that have been raised. It may not be adequate, but I think it's assisting to a very large extent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. But just before you conclude your submission, I don't know if you clarified the issue with regards to the acting DDGs in the two programs.
I thought DM would take it up. The matter of DDGs, the ministry is working on. Thank you very much.
I think you are correct to say that you might not be adequate in all the responses that you are giving, but you are giving what you can. Because with regards to that one, it seems like comrades have been working on that one for quite some time. But nonetheless, the submissions that you have presented to the Portfolio Committee today are recognized in the manner in which you've presented them. Thank you very much. Comrades will see, or honorable members, I'm so used to chairing the ANC study group and not the Portfolio Committee that I end up calling people comrades. But we will meet tomorrow at 9:30 to look at the Council on Higher Education, the South African Qualifications Authority, the Quality Council for Trades and Occupations. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.